This is the What Matters Most podcast. A 100% listener-supported program. And now, here is your host, Paul Samuel Dolman.
Welcome back to What Matters Most. So appreciative and grateful to have listeners all over the world. Thanks for writing in, supporting the show. Today is a show so close to my heart and soul. I grew up in Miami, and I was just a rabid Miami Dolphins fan through 1969. Well, forever. I still root for them, but we used to go to the Orange Bowl, and they were the greatest teams ever. And I was a football guy, and today we have the ultimate hero of the team. He was one of the big three or four. I know it was a team effort, but a five-time Pro Bowler, three-time first-team All-Pro, Hall of Fame member, number 39. The great Larry Zonka, and he has written an incredible book I highly recommend called Head On. It's just one great story after another. What an honor to welcome Larry to the show. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you for that introduction, Paul. I hope I can live up to it.
How are you feeling? You know, you took a million hits, and I see a lot of guys that I know, the old pros or different levels, even younger guys limping around. How does your body feel these days?
Actually, I can't complain. I'm 75, soon to be 76, I guess. And when I look around, I think I complain a lot. And then I get around some of the other fellas and I realize I'm doing great compared to a lot of them. So it's just, you know, you get the aches and pains, and I'm thankful that I'm having the aches and pains in my mid to late 70s versus my mid to late 40s or 50s, as a lot of guys have. And I was very fortunate with the head trauma, because back when I played, head contact was not only not avoided, it was promoted. And so a lot of trauma to the brain because of that. And I'm actually very, very lucky. I think about it every once in a while. I was out cutting brush in North Carolina at our place yesterday, and you know, it's like, obviously I wouldn't insult your intelligence. I'm not Paul Bunyan, but I kind of limp up the hill and limp back down the hill and get some brush cut. But I enjoy it, because that's how I grew up in Ohio. I put that in the book and talked about my childhood in Ohio and how I loved nature so much. And that's how I went to Alaska and did a lot of other things after my football career was over. And I like being out, and that's a way to get good exercise as well.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned the head trauma, because especially the way your style was so brutal. And I watched the old games. There was so much hitting contact. You remember Tatum, Atkinson, all those guys, Butkus. And CTE is a real thing, and I wondered if you were concerned about it. Obviously, you're sharp.
Well, very concerned about it. When you have never experienced the monster face on, you're not sure what he is. So every time, you know, I have a little memory fade or something, I think, well, maybe that's that CTE setting in. But I think, I was never the brainiac anyway, so I can't really, when it comes to forgetting things, I've been good at it since I was 12. If it was something I wasn't interested in particularly, all in all, be quite frank with you, Paul, I think I'm ahead of the game. I think that comes down to DNA and what you inherit from your ancestors, and what, if you're lucky enough to have a thick skull and a high impact rate for your brain that can withstand that, then you're blessed in the old NFL.
Yeah, and I wonder, too, if your vigor for life and being outside, I don't know if that scientifically has anything to do with it, but they always say, like, if you have a great love for life and a positive attitude, we've had surgeons and all these specialists on, that recovery is better, you don't get as sick, you might miss things that other people get. Maybe that plays into it, too, as well as being lucky on the genetic end.
Absolutely, Paul. I agree with you 100%. I think your general outlook, just your feelings towards it. Like, you know, I'm not going to let this get me down. I'm going to strive for my goals. I'm still going to attain. If I can't attain the full goal, I'm going to get as far as I can with it, just to demonstrate to myself that I'm not going to give in. I think the worst thing you can do is decide you're defeated before you're defeated.
Your old buddy, Jim Kick, didn't he suffer CTE, and a couple of the other guys we lost, like Bonaconi on that team?
Absolutely. Very prominent in their final days. And that, you know, that's a sad thing to see some of your close friends and teammates go that way. And particularly when all the COVID was going down and they had to be just privatized to the point where you couldn't go and see them. And to die in those kind of situations, it's just doubly tough. It's doubly tough on the person that's going through it, and it's doubly tough on all the people, all the loved ones that are around them.
Well put, too. And you guys stayed close, too. And a part of it is that toasting the champagne, because no one can break the undefeated record. So you guys have that bond. And do you guys keep in touch? A lot of guys on the team that are still around? Is it a team that stayed united and connected?
Absolutely. And what you're referring to is exactly the reason why. As teams go on now, we're reaching the thing. The Dolphins are 2-0. I think the Bucks, there's several of them that are 2-0. And now we're, you know, that's when the attention span starts to turn to it. Like, okay, who's going to beat this one? Who's going to beat that one? And each year you're back being competitive again. There's a little taste of that competition that went down 50 years ago this year. That we're still competing, and it's 50 years later, because we don't want anybody to attain. They can't beat us. They can only tie us. But at the same time, we don't want anybody else standing on the platform. We're kind of we're a little piggish in that regard. We just like being, you know, we like the corn trough all to ourselves, and we don't want to share it. But if it occurs, then you have to honor it and recognize it for what it is, because perfection is just that. You only attain it. It's not... Yeah, just a little less or a little more, it's perfect. And if that's attained, then you have to recognize it.
And this is pathetic, Larry. I'm just a fan, and I want us to stay us, like I'm on the team. I want us to be undefeated. And the two biggest scares I ever had was the Bears. And sure. Thank God Marino knocked him off on that Monday night game at home.
Yep.
Unbelievable game. And then the other scare was when New England was about to win, and thank God the Giants knocked him off in the Super Bowl.
But coached by my old teammate at Syracuse, Tom Coughlin. I call Tom frequently and still remind him of that and thank him. I've thanked him so many times, he's probably tired of hearing it. At any rate, you know, boy, that game, just when Tyree caught that football on the side of his helmet at the end, I jumped up and hit my head in the ceiling fan or outside rec room where we got the TV set. Almost got a concussion from that one.
I know. And I was screaming when Burroughs caught the TD, and some people down the street said, "Whoa, is everything okay?" And I said, "Oh, I'm embarrassed. I'm watching the football game."
Well, you're an avid fan. And when you say we, you are correct. It's we. 10,000 people came to the airport and welcomed us back after some of those games. And our fans were there early before the games and stayed for hours after the game, sat around a campfire, much to the chagrin of the Miami Police Department. They finally gave up and joined us. But our fans were part of our crew, and it was called the 12th man syndrome. That Orange Bowl was very close. crowd was very close to the field. And I felt sorry for some of the opposing quarterbacks trying to call signals down on the closed end of the stadium. It was just a madhouse. It was so loud you could feel the vibration over on the bench.
Oh, so true. And I remember I was at a lot of those games. You could literally feel the team lifted in crucial situations.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Get it right on the head.
Gives me goosebumps now, like digging in on a fourth down, or you making a fourth and one, or a couple of the teams that threw a scare. And it was just, God, it was some great plays.
What a perfect ending, or a perfect paramount to a situation. I went to the Dolphins in 68 when all the rioting was going on and the social disorders and the strife between the races. Everything was coming down to a head. And Miami is one of the leading cities that was having all that strife with marches and disenchanted people and violence. And then all of a sudden to have a team where everybody could get together. And it didn't matter. None of that background or social disgruntledness, it didn't matter. We were all Dolphin fans, and we got there 2 hours or 3 hours before the game, and we stayed for 6 hours after the game. And we enjoyed each other's company, and it went over all those boundaries. All those divisions were kind of eradicated. And I think that was a central gathering point that was a very good thing in a very tough time.
That's such an observation. Sports is such a uniter. And I remember being at games and you could be next to a total stranger of any color. And if there was some great play, you're high-fiving and hugging like your family, because sports transcends race, color, creed, and beliefs.
Absolutely. And that's the best thing about it. You couldn't find anything that's more American than football. Well, I'm not going to say just football. Basketball, baseball, it's all the same thing. We're great sports fans in this country because we choose to be. Nobody's telling us to be. We want to be. And as part of that, then you start to accept these other social things that seemingly become glaringly opposed to each other in different social contexts. But all of a sudden, we're cast into a lot as fans, and it's all one common goal. And it, well, it's a great mixing pot. And I think it's one of the basic elements that helps democracy.
Larry, what do you remember about Miami like in the 69, 70, 71, 72? What the city was like? I mean, you must have been on the top of the world. Here you are, like the star of the team, young guy, tall. You got the Burt Reynolds mustache. You and Jim are roaming around. You got a nickname. What was that like? I mean, here you grew up on a farm. Now you're like you are a celebrity. How did you handle it?
It was fun. We, and kind of tongue in cheek, when we were out in the public, we gave that appearance, and it was very kicked back and, pardon the pun, and laid back and very just taking it as it comes. But see, that demeanor and that representation was incorrect, because Shula was the ultimate coach, and he was the ultimate detail-oriented, winning edge concept, you know, every little tiny edge that we can have, where the sun's going to be at 3 o'clock in the stadium, you know, all those things were things that he thought of and worried about and made us cognizant of. So the minute that you went in with that kickback attitude, like Jim and I had and everything, that was flying out in Miami and walking around town and enjoying it with the fans. But when you walked into that locker room in the morning, you better have your assignment studied and be prepared to answer questions about it, because he was something of a tyrant. And I use the word in the sense of the social order of teams. You know, there was no tyranny in the fact that he was evil or anything. He was dictatorial in a sense of demanding perfection. And he wanted that, because you remember he came to us partly because he lost his Super Bowl against Namath.
They got upset in the Orange Bowl, and he was with that great Colts team.
Yeah, exactly. He was very disarranged over that. The owner was very disgruntled with that of the Colts. And, you know, we were lucky enough to land Shula, and we did. So he still had that chip on his shoulder. Then we put a team together with him as our leader and went and got to the Super Bowl, but lost to the Dallas Cowboys. I've had the honor of being picked up by my face by Bob Lilly, throwing on the ground, and he took the ball on top of it. So, you know, I still have nightmares about that play. Now Shula, picture Shula now. That's what we're talking about, how he got so dictatorial. He's 0-2 in Super Bowls. He's going to Super Bowls, but he can't seem to win them. So now he's got a chip on his shoulder. So he used that Super Bowl loss as the foundation that we stood on to go the next year. And we ended up going undefeated the next year, because he said, we're going to treat each game as though it were the Super Bowl and not miss any details. We're going to be totally concentrated on what is at hand. We're not going to look ahead to the Super Bowl or look ahead to the playoffs or look ahead to next week. We're going to play this week. And because of that, I think if we beat Dallas in Super Bowl, what was that, Super Bowl six, I think, whatever it was, and that maybe the perfect season would have never happened, but because we lost, and particularly because he was 0-2 in Super Bowls, he was the dynamo. He was the essence of that 72 season. From the time you pulled in that parking lot, you know, we were just kidding about how laid back and how the reputations were translated around town and how we were all happy and having a great time and in Miami. That all stopped at the entrance to Biscayne College, where our training was. When you pulled in there, from the way you parked your car, I heard him get after guys because of the way they were parking in the parking lot. No detail was too small. We do things in an orderly, pre-thought fashion. I've heard him say that hundreds of times walking through the locker room. We did not have any kind of glorious facilities. We had a whole beat up locker room. His response to that was, when we bitched about the locker room, you don't hit them with your locker room. That was his response. So, Paul, you see what I'm talking about. He was the dynamo. He was the generator. That's where the electricity came from. And I'll tell you what, that man probably would have lived another 10 or 12 years had he not been put himself through that, because I know it had to drain him.
Could you get close to him, Larry, or was he an aloof, separate figure? I know you had mutual respect and you guys would clash, and he probably respected you for that too.
Absolutely, Paul. You hit it right on the head. When he first got there, look at where he's coming from. From Baltimore, Johnny Unitas, a passing team. You know, he was a defensive back when he played for the Browns years before. You know that he's more pass-oriented. So when he became the new head coach, I figured, well, I'm out of here. I'm going somewhere. I may end up in Cleveland. Who knows where I'm going, you know. Power, slow, big, strong, powerful fullback, you know, that doesn't fit into his plan. So I just walked into his office after about 2 days of his scrutiny on the field when he first got there. And he said, you know, when you come in my office, he said, all titles are off. He said, I'm no longer coach. We're man to man. We're talking. So that was his policy. So I figured, well, what do I got to lose? I'm probably not going to be on this team anyway. So I went in, and about, you know, the second or third day, I became really disgruntled in what I was having to do in practice and the way he was going on about it. So I just walked in the office, and he said, what's on? You know, I shut the door like he prescribed, turned around, and he said, what's on your mind? I said, I don't like you. And he said, I don't like you. He said, for what it's worth, I don't like you either. I said, well, what am I doing here? Why don't you trade me? He said, I would, but I can't get anything for you. That's how it started, Paul. But that was good in the sense that it didn't, you know, first reaction to that is, well, there's two men that don't like each other. Well, it's kind of, in sports, it's kind of unimportant whether you like each other or not. You know, if you dislike each other, it's probably a little better because you make fewer mistakes because you have more criticism. But, and you try to avoid that. But the fact that we both, you know, we were right in the basement floor. That's as low as it was going to get. We were standing on the concrete looking at each other, and we just got done telling each other we don't like each other. And I'm not going anywhere because you can't get anything. Where do we go from here? And that's when he talked about, you know, maybe changing his coaching methods to realize what we might have. And he brought up Monty Clark, who was a great offensive tackle in front of Jimmy Brown up at the Cleveland Browns. It was our offensive line coach that Coach Shula had hired. And how that Monty Clark felt that might be able to put some kind of power running game together with the addition of a couple linemen, based around the fact that we had Larry Little already. And that was a glimmer of hope for me. And that gave me basis to stick around and see if I could make it. But because of that clarity, because of that honesty, that clarity in dealing with reality, you know, if this works, fine, we'll go this way. If it doesn't, well, then maybe you're right. We don't know what we're going to do, but we'll have to do something. But in any fact, when I walked out of that office, I had renewed respect. I liked him as a coach, but I had new respect for the man when I walked out of that room. And I thought, this guy's thinking, and he's thinking about all the possibilities, and he's putting it together one block at a time. And you have to admire that, because he was that into it. He wasn't a rah-rah guy that jumped up, and he would jump up and holler lots of times. But he wasn't, he would clap his hands, but that's about as far as it went. He didn't tell anybody that he loved them, or there was no respect. You know, it was, we're going to get together and this is our goal. And he didn't treat it necessarily as stringent as military, but it was in an intelligence approach. You know, we're going to approach this intelligently. We're going to look at all the little details. We're going to remember them. And if he tested you on any of those little details prior to the game, particularly down 2 days or, you know, 1 or 2 days before the game, and you couldn't answer him on the spot, it was not a good thing. He was not a happy guy. You know, that would be the best way to get a ticket out of town right there.
Boy, you're just laying out all these pillars of success and good for life or coaching or anything, good leadership, clear communication, flexibility, respect of a human being. And Shula went from passing to the power running game. And then later when Marino comes, he's flexible again. He turns into the great passing team. And you talked about Monty Clark. That whole organization, the coaching was extraordinary. Arnsberger, the defensive genius, Schnellenberger, all these guys went on to massive success later, the Shula coaching tree. And then George Young and Beathard put together the most incredible roster. That offensive line, maybe except for Wayne Moore, who was solid. Those are all Hall of Fame guys. Kuchenberg, Langer, Larry Little, right? Unbelievable team.
Absolutely. Kuchenberg didn't make it, but he's certainly been up and voted on. It was right on the edge for 10 years or whatever. I consider, you know, I'd be happy to hand him my place in the Hall of Fame because he put me in there. So it would only be fair. But those coaches that you just alluded to were exactly that. They were the guys that shared Shula's enthusiasm for perfection. They weren't as stringent as towing the line as he was, but he didn't hesitate to put his foot in anybody's rump in a minute if he thought you were. The worst thing you could do with Coach Shula, and I think this sums it up, Paul. The worst thing you could do, the most insulting thing you could do to him, was to go out and take an attitude of just cruising through practice. You know, you were just going to just cruise through and not pay a lot of attention. You weren't really into it. You were just going through the motions. That's the words I want right there. If he thought you were going through the motions, he would come over and stand in your proximity, and he wouldn't look right at you. He'd be watching you peripherally out of the corner of his eye. And once he was sure that you were just going through the motions, he would turn and lay a bevy of verbiage on you. You remember, you didn't want to be singled out and harassed in the middle of practice and belittled or whatever it is. It was humiliating because it wasn't terribly humiliating, but just the fact that he had to talk to you to get you to be aware, he didn't like that. It was a bad thing. And you learn to really think about what was happening in front of you, the practice things that were happening, even when the second team, the backup team, was going through the play that we had just run. You still had to watch and pay attention and be involved in it. Because if he thought you weren't, you know, he had very disciplined practice times. We would go out and we'd only be on the field for like 45 minutes. But would run your ass off in that 45 minutes because he was very quick and stringent, you know, one thing right after the other. And we went through each one and you're supposed to do, and he'd film it and then go study the films to see who muffed it or who didn't have his winning edge in mind. You know, who was going through the motions, just like I said before. And then later he would come to you before the next practice and say, you know, I looked at the films this morning of you, and you're standing way in the back, not paying attention when the second team's duplicating, the second team offense is running the same play that we just run. I said, well, it's boring, Coach. He said, boring doesn't fit here. He said, if you want to fit here, get with it. And there you go. I mean, that's it. But see, that attention to detail, Paul, came after we lost to Dallas in Super Bowl VI, I believe, and then we came back and won against the Redskins in 7 on the perfect season. But that's how finite he got. Before we played Super Bowl VII against the Washington Redskins, I think that was in the L.A. Coliseum, he flew out the week before on a Sunday. We had the morning off or the day off. And before we did the final week of preparation before the Super Bowl out in Los Angeles, before we flew out, he went out a couple of days ahead of that and sat in that stadium and diagrammed where the sun was every half hour. He wanted to make sure that he got the right bench and the right selection, and he wanted to know what kind of plays to call based on where the sun was going to be in the eyes of the receiver. Paul, that's how finite. When I tell you he's finite, that's how your weight, you know, he gave me a weight that was 5 pounds under what I should be. You know, my weight, I was 245 and I was slim at 240. And I'm not a speedster. I'm not going to beat anybody to the goal line. You know, I'm going to get down 20 yards is going to be the best I do. The whole team's going to tackle me. But the reality of the thing is, he's figuring if I'm lighter, I'm faster. Well, that may be, but I'm also weaker. So my argument with him was when he gave me a weight of 235, I said, Coach, I'm 10 pounds heavier than that. That's going to be a nightmare. But listen to this, Paul. This is the real insight that's even it didn't dawn on me until 30 years later. He gave Earl Morrill a crazy way, a backup quarterback. So all these fellas that were overweight in his mind were there on weigh-in days way before the practice time, so that we could sit in the sauna and sweat off the last 2 pounds of weight that we worked hard to make. But what happened from that? We moved furniture in the side of the locker room, and there was a little area to sit down. And all the guys that he decided were fat guys were like Earl Morrill, myself, Bob Kuchenberg. There was a bunch of us that would come in and spend time in each other's company. And we would complain about Shula. But see, what he was doing there, I really think, was it wasn't necessarily the weight, but it was a common thread. We would get together and predominantly bitch about him. But the fact was we were together spending time. The closer the team gets, the more they understand each other's personalities, the more social interaction, it's more beneficial to the team concept. We get to share outlooks. Sometimes guys get in each other's nerves and get distant from each other. That happens on teams. But if you have a lot in common, and Shula gave us a common thing, we all like to get together and bitch about him.
It reminds me of the Dirty Dozen, the way they all hated Lee Marvin, and he did it on purpose, and then they bonded.
That's it.
And Morrill lived around the corner from us. Poor Oral. I used to go over there and bug the shit out of him every time he was out cutting his yard, asking him a million questions. But one thing was common, like you. He would complain about Shula to a kid in his neighborhood.
That was a common thread. Yeah, we all did. But he gave us the perfect season. And I, you know, if one man had the bigger piece of that pie, it would certainly be Coach Shula, because he needed a double helping, because he was the promoter, the designer, and finally the purveyor of what had to transpire in order to obtain it. And he was there. And I've never seen a more gratifying look on his face than when they handed him that trophy in the locker room. That's the only trophy I ever saw him take, you know, and actually handle. He wouldn't touch a game football. He didn't want anything. He wanted that Super Bowl trophy. And he not only got it, but he got the number one team in the first 100 years of the NFL is what he attained.
And people probably don't remember, but a lot of those games in that season were close. Greasy went out at San Diego. I think it was Deacon Jones broke his ankle, but and then Earl comes in, and you guys pull out a lot of close games, and it was the attention to detail, especially at that pro level, that was the difference between winning and losing. You went into that Super Bowl as the underdog and could have shut him out. That defense could have shut him out, except Garrett tried to be greasy, and Mike Bass ran that pass back. But other than that, it could have been 17-0 or more.
The fact of it was that it should have been 17-0, and how much, you know, that's almost destiny, 17-0 in a 17-0 season, perfection. I think of when you talk about different guys, we had a backup rookie named Charlie Babb who saw something in a movie when we were playing Cleveland, and he thought he could block the punt or block the punter, block the kick, and the punter, and went to the, I think Schnellenberger, Howard Arnsberger, one of them, he went to one of the coaches and talked to him about it. And finally, they got Shula, and they all sat in a room and looked at it. And they said, you know, Charlie, you're right. Maybe this could do it. And then in the game, Charlie took the advantage. You know, he's a rookie now. Think about this. He goes in and blocks the punt against Cleveland in our undefeated season and picks it up and scores with it. And that turned that game around. That's the game we probably would have lost and, you know, would have shut the whole thing down. But see, you know, you don't have to be the starting quarterback. You don't have to be the starting middle linebacker or safety or defensive end, any of that. Here's a guy that's only getting on the field for maybe 5 to 7 plays a game at that point in time. And he made the difference in us winning because he was so alert and in tune with what was happening. That's the essence of what happened that season, the very building blocks of what were put together that made it work. And because here's a guy that's, you know, not even a starting player, and he made the difference on that play in that game.
You're reminding me and thinking of punting in that season when Larry Seipel in the playoffs took off against the Steelers on that. Well, I think he ran about 39 yards. And then it was, wasn't it one play or two plays later? Then Greasy threw a pass in the flat to you and you ran through Mel Blount, all pro, and went in for the touchdown, changed the whole game and the momentum.
Yeah, I think it happened pretty quickly there after Seipel took off with the ball. And it, you know, Shula, he, again, there's Seipel. And Seipel's one of our best. He's a backup tight. He's a backup everything. He could play defensive back. He could play quarterback if he had to. He could throw the ball well. Seipel was probably the best all-around football player, offense, defense, special teams, all of it combined that we had. And when he saw something and decided that they were turning around trying to get Frenchie Fuqua was the name of that. I was trying to think of that name while I was talking about the rest of it. I was trying to think of that name. Frenchie Fuqua was a guy that had the glass high-heel shoes and had a goldfish in his heel. He a colorful guy. I kind of liked him. But he was such a great punt returner that they were really concentrating on returning the punt. And because of that, the safety guy was one of the defensive ends. I don't recall which one. But they were turning and going to set up the return wall and trying to block for Frenchie before the ball was kicked. You got to make sure that ball gets kicked before you do any of those kind of preparations to try to return it. But they weren't. And Seipel saw it in the movies, in the special teams movies. And because of that, he went to Shula and talked about it. Shula said, well, we'll get about it later on. Saying, yeah, Shula said, yeah, do it. But, you know, if you're going home with us, you better make it. You got to make that decision, but just be sure. And you couldn't emphasize that enough. And Seipel did it. And it was, my gosh, he ran about 25 or 30 yards down there. He was running. You'll love this, Paul. We're in the Pittsburgh Stadium, and we're undefeated in the Pittsburgh Stadium, which I don't understand. But back then, playoffs were way. But Seipel's running down through there and literally had the Pittsburgh Steelers running ahead of him, setting up the wall for Fuqua. It actually looked like they were leading his charge, you know. And the fans are screaming. They're almost falling. They're throwing beers and Coca-Cola and everything at the field and screaming, turn around. And finally they did, and they tackled Seipel, but he was way down close to the end zone. And then we took it in, as you alluded to. But that was a major, what you just, right there is exactly what I was talking about. That was a major turning point in the game. One guy, one play made the difference in the undefeated season. And you talk about, well, you know, being undefeated, you won the Super Bowl and won the whole thing. And other people come within one game. Well, one game's very close. It's like 1 inch, but 1 inch represents the universe if you're talking about perfection. You either have it or you don't. It's a yes or no, top or bottom situation. And we got it. And that's the only time in the history of the NFL that it was completed.
So what happens when you reach the pinnacle? You're only 4 years, I think, into the franchise, 17-0, Super Bowl, dynasty maybe. How do you get up for the 73 season? Where do you go from there? How did Shula motivate you guys? Because you can't be 18-0. I mean, how do you keep going?
He said, we're going to go one game at a time, and we're going to concentrate. And we did pretty much in 73. I think, I'll be honest with you, Paul, I believe as far as power and flexing muscle, the 73 team was stronger than the 72 team, and probably would have been easier for the 73 team to go undefeated than it was for the 72. But how long can you keep that kind of pace up? How long is it humanly possible to maintain that kind of intensity? It's just, at some point, you know, your circulation system has to give out. And you say, wait a minute, I've got to sleep. I've got to sit down and rest here. And that's what happened when we played Oakland, out in Oakland, in that 73 season.
And they always gave us trouble, too. I hated that team.
Oh, yeah. Well, they were a well-coached team.
John Madden
was he's another. I don't know if they wore the same size shoes, but I'm sure one could. They walked in each other's shoes. Same attitude, same approach. George Allen. There were several of them that were in the league that were detail-oriented, winning-edge kind of guys.
Well, you beat them in the playoffs when it mattered most, and for revenge. That was the greatest game. You guys dominated that second half. And I always remember the great Dick Anderson hit on Marv Hubbard going over the top on fourth down and creamed them. The ball went flying. And then I think it was Den Herter or Stanfill sacked Stable, and that was it. No, Curtis Johnson was in the backfield. And then you guys went on. And you had, was that 73 Super Bowl when you won the MVP? Was that maybe the peak highlight of your professional playing for you?
I think the peak highlight was being a member of the 72 team. I nothing surpasses that. I'm so proud to be in a I did well in a team sport, and that's great, but it's a team sport. And you never find anything that's more a team sport than football, particularly professional football in this country. Everybody's got to make their commitment. Everybody's got to make their sacrifice. Everybody has to be there and show up game day. And to be part of that 72 team is far more, means far more to me than any of my personal, I don't even keep track of that stuff. It doesn't matter. What matters was that one time I got to take the bus, and there were no stops. You know, we were the express. We went right downtown. We sit on top of the mountain. As far as I'm concerned, I, like every other guy that's on that team, share a spot of equality and represent the best team in 100 years. That's quite an honor to be able to say that. And I appreciate that. And as far as anything personal in my career, that's second place to being part of that. And I think most of the guys, I think all of the guys on the 72 team will share what I just said with you. It means far more than any single season of accomplishment other, on a personal basis, to having been part of that 72 team. Think about Charlie Babb, you know, the whole thing, you know, it's all that ring on our finger. It's the only one I wear. That it comes down to him making that play that day in that game, in that moment. And that's pretty cool.
The worst loss of probably my fan life ever was in 74 in the Sea of Hands, and Clarence Davis got that ball. Because I wanted us to go to four Super Bowls, and I really wanted the ultimate showdown of you guys in the Steel Curtain. I would have loved to seen that game. Was that the hardest loss? Is there a hardest loss in your career, or do you let the losses go? They come and they go.
I try to let them go, but I don't think you ever do. It's the frustration of standing on the sideline, seeing that, and you just see a hand, it was just right down to the absolute. Well, that's the difference. That's what we talked about with Charlie Babb in the play in 72. So what goes around comes around in the NFL. That's what makes it such fun to watch. I tell you, I think it's more competitive than it's ever been. I think the rules have changed. You can't compare players from my era to players today. I don't think that's the same. You know, one's peanuts and one's popcorn, but it's different, but it's more competitive because it's much more pass oriented, and a team can be 21 points down. They've demonstrated it several times. Oh my gosh, up there in New England, they demonstrated several times coming, being down a couple of touchdowns at halftime and just come roaring back and win it.
Yeah. Miami won yesterday that way. They were down three and then two. Yeah, Tua had that great game.
Absolutely. You know, you can't ever take your eyes off the screen, because at any moment there might be a 60, 80, 100-yard touchdown scored. The probability of that back when I played was next to none. So it's more competitive today, and it's more fast action. And I'll be quite honest with you, I miss the power running game. I miss ball control. But as from a fan's standpoint, if you don't really understand the workings of the power running game and ball control football, it's kind of boring to watch. It's very intricate. It's very enthusiastic. It's very rewarding to be part of it as an athlete. But from the stands, it's kind of what happened. But when you see a guy throw a ball and it goes 60 yards downfield, and you see a guy dive and make a fingertip catch, what's not to understand? So that's why it's been good for the fans in the stands, because they never go home at halftime just because they're 21 points down, because so they can still come back. I mean, you can come back in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, only the hardcore people are going to be into blocking schemes and all that kind of, and all these different, you know, type of stuff in the running game. You got to be a real nerd like I was. And I got to ask you about Alaska, too, because it's such a big part of your life. When did you first go there, and when did you fall so in love with that beautiful state?
I didn't get there. I fell in love with it when I saw it on the front of a magazine many years ago. I was probably 8 or 9 years old. My mother brought me in Field and Stream or something, and it had a picture of a Kodiak bear down by catching a fish with a fisherman was hooked to the line at the same time. And I memorized everything they wrote in there about Alaska. And I just dreamt of that in the kind of Daniel Boone, Davy Crockett days, you know, as a kid growing up. I pictured that as the last frontier, and it pretty much is and still is. And just dreamt about getting there, but I couldn't get there. I originally was going, after college, I was going to just hitchhike up there and get up there and, you know, work on some of the fishing boats or something. But football came up, and I, you know, got steered into that. Had a wife and two young sons, so it got delayed another 20 years. And then after, right about the time the USFL fell and collapsed, I decided to end the speaking career and end the participation in football. I was going up to Alaska and start to look around and try to get, if possible, a TV show about Alaska. And that's what transpired. And to make a long story short, it worked out. But I got to go because we were depicting different areas of Alaska on the outdoor sports show. I got to go to some of the most remote places in Alaska there are, and they're still there, and enjoy that and get to know the people that lived there, the people that were there for thousands of years. And it was an experience. I put in the book a little bit about it. I was standing on a river one night and thinking about all of that, and the northern lights came down and came down the river. And it's a little bit, it's the only time anything like this ever happened in my life. I don't see ghosts. I don't communicate with dead people. I'm not one of those. I don't particularly believe in it. Don't disbelieve in it. But at the same time, it just doesn't happen to me. But I was standing on the river and the northern lights came down and touched the ground, and blues and purples and, you know, kind of twinkly, came down the river and went right across me. I saw it on my arms. I reached out, looked down, and I could see it on my arms. That's the only time that's ever happened to me in my life. And I thought, I had the feeling like I'm in the right spot at the right time. In other words, I was supposed to do this. I belong here. And I, because of the way I grew up on a farm in Ohio and out back, I talk about that in the book. I was, you know, the middle child in a big family, and there's older siblings were like 4 or 5 years older because of the war. And the younger siblings were 4 or 5 years younger than I. So I kind of grew up in the middle by myself, and I was out in the woods all the time and with critters because we're so far out of town. I fell in love with the outdoors, and I fell in love with wildlife. And you couldn't get any more outdoors and more wildlife. You know, when I saw that Kodiak bear on the cover of that magazine, mother brought it home from the store, from the grocery store, because she knew I liked the outdoors and knew that I liked that kind of thing. Bought me that magazine, and I just cherished it. I must have carried that thing around for 5 years. And then couldn't wait to get there, and then got delayed. But by the time I got there, then... And we had some success with it. The TV market was very ready. A lot of other people share my enthusiasm towards Alaska and want to go and see it and put it off. And sometimes their whole life never get to go. But trust me, it's worth it. And the more remote you can get, if you're an outdoor person and you like wildlife, you need to go to Alaska. Call me. I'll tell you where to go. On what parts, depending on what kind of wildlife you like. You know, if it's bears, you got the Kodiak Island. If it's fish, I won't get into all of it. But, you know, after spending 20 years up there and doing a show for 14 of those 20 years, 20 plus years, I got to know the state pretty well. And there's places to go and hunt and places to go and camp and just enjoy the outback that are just sensational. I mean, not that our national parks in the lower 48 aren't superb. They are. But Alaska's got something else to it.
A guy I know wrote a book called Searching for Alaska, Peter Friedman. And he told me, go to Alaska last because everything else won't seem that beautiful after you see Alaska.
There you go. That's great advice.
And I'm going to hold you to that. I'm going to get your number because I want to go up there. I'm a big nature. To me, I've never been religious, but I'm very spiritual, and nature is my cathedral. And when you're talking about the Northern Lights, to me, that's, call it what you want, God, mystery, divinity, higher power. Those are words.
There's something else out there.
There's something else out there, Larry. And you almost made me cry when you said I was born. I was actually at tears in my eyes. I was floating on a boat in Northern Canada in late September with the woman I loved, the engines off. And oh, I'm going to cry. The Northern Lights came down, like, and they were on the sky. And I swear, I felt like it was interacting with us personally and touching us. And I was always kind of agnostic. And after that, I never was. I said, oh my God, I don't know what it is, but it touched my soul and I'll never be the same. So when you talked about that, I have personal, and that's a spirituality, isn't that? That's not our religion, but that's our practice. When you're out there, that's it.
Connection to the ultimate force, which is out there. And I think it's a good force. So I like to think of it in tune with that. But when those lights come down and they come close to you or come across you, it's like the rainbow coming down right, 30 feet from you and then traveling right across, standing in the rainbow. I've had people tell me that. It never happened to me, but until that time of the Northern Lights. And what an experience. It just pleased me so much. It felt like, okay, I'm here and I'm at the mountaintop. This is it. It don't get any better than this.
And it just doesn't touch you on the outside. I felt like it goes through you, and it feels like your soul was touched, whatever that is.
Well, I don't know. I've never thought about it that way, but I can't argue with that. But it's definitely a moment. It's definitely one of the high points in your life, particularly if you're an outdoor person and you like you lean towards nature much more than downtown Manhattan. If you're of that persuasion and you go to Alaska and you see the Northern Lights, just seeing them in, June all the way to September is magnificent. They are it's just a show. The further north you get, the brighter the show gets, the more of the sky it takes up. And sometimes it just goes on for hours up there and you just lay on the ground on a sleeping bag. I've had guys come and wake me up in the tent and say, Zonk, you got to get out here. These Northern Lights are just going, wow. And I go out and lay down. I've had camera guys get so frustrated because it's very, very difficult to try to record a photograph. Yeah, they were trying to record them. That's how long they were going on. It's like Star Wars is up in the sky and it's going on in all this magnificent color. And now we're way north. We're up by the boundary there, by the Arctic Circle up there. Or I can't think of the name of it, but it's far north in Alaska. And it when you get up that high and you get you're lucky enough to get a clear night in the fall, it's just spectacular. It just starts at sunset or right after sunset, just goes on for a couple hours. And it's just Star Wars in the sky. Now that's not every night, it's when they're aligned, whenever things line up perfectly, I guess, but having experienced it a dozen or two times where they were just spectacular shows going on in the sky, and then be lucky enough to be actually standing there and have a spire of it come down and come across you. That's quite an experience.
I've never met anyone where that happened, and that's incredible. Hey, when you were on that boat in the storm, and did you think you might die? What was that like?
I was pretty sure that it would
work. Where you get, I've been in a storm once and I thought, well, this is a weird way to die. I'm done.
Well, we're out there off of northern Alaska and, about a third of the way out to Russia, I think, it's Bering Sea. And we couldn't get back in time. And a storm caught up, hit us faster than what we had anticipated. And we ended up in a, 35 or 36 foot boat that we couldn't get into the harbor. And we literally spent the night fighting the waves. It was a very close call, about as close as you can get without. And if we roll over in that sea, the Bering Sea, under those circumstances, even with a lifeboat, your chances of survival probably 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 100 and 1 in 1,000. What difference to make? if the coldness of the water doesn't get you, you know, you're going to drown, just become drenched and sink. But it was a moment to moment situation. And for about 6 hours, or 4 to 6 hours, I suppose. And then the Navy guys came and picked us up. The Coast Guard, excuse me, came and picked us up. My son's a Coast Guard veteran, and he doesn't like it when I say Navy. Yeah. Coast Guard picked us up and saved our lives, you know, and pulled us out of there. And it was a quite an experience. And I share it in the book because it you're living, you know, you got some 20-foot plus waves that are coming, and about every seventh wave comes from a different direction for some reason. I don't know what that's all about, but it does. And when you think you're down consistent and you're going to make it, then all of a sudden this rogue wave hits you and you're almost upset. So you're just living, actually living from minute to minute for the course of 4 or 5 hours. And that, just going through that, makes you realize a lot of things. When your feet get back on the ground, you're not the same person as before. Now, I'm not talking about, you know, just rough weather, and just, I'm talking about actually thinking you're going to die, you know, once or twice a minute, 4 hours. And, you know, that has an impact. That wilderness, it's that. And if you don't prepare for it correctly, and as correctly as we tried to, we still just, pardon the expression, we just missed the boat. And we took too small a boat, too big a sea. And it was flat calm when we went out, and we were just going to zip out and film a few things and zip back. But by the time we went to zip back, we couldn't make the turn because of the wind. So we ended up going out to sea, and we were headed for Russia. Yeah, it was bad. As bad as it gets. And I'll tell you, my camera guys and myself and Audrey and the captain, we said a few prayers, you know. I don't know who those guys are that run the Northern Lights, but I'm glad they heard us, because they we made it. So that's the deal.
You read my mind. I was thinking, whatever's behind that, your number wasn't up. Do you feel like you're on borrowed time ever after that experience?
Well, I think your outlook, quite frankly, changes drastically. You know, I used to get very hyper and excited and get all worried. I worried about finances. I worried about health. You worry about all kinds of things. And then when you get past the age of about 55 or 68, you experience something like that, you realize, you know, in the next minute and a half, you're liable to be dead. And that goes on for 4 hours. When you get out of that, you start to see people getting excited because the parking meter doesn't work, or, you know, the car won't start. You start to see a little humor in that, instead of, you know, like, what difference does that make? If you're late, so what? You know, I know it. I talked about perfection and how Shula brought us to the edge, and you had to be that hyper. If you want to achieve those things, you have to do that. But when you're living your life, I don't think everything can be perfect. You know, you reach that here and there, but you learn to be tolerant instead of getting excited and hitting each other over the head with our coffee mugs, let's talk about, you know, let's find something that we've got in common, and we'll start there. And I think that kind of attitude towards life happens to you if you're post 50 and you're living minute to minute for about 4 hours, thinking you're going to die. I think that does change you. And I know it changed me. And I assume that I've always kind of considered myself in the middle of the pack. I'm neither hither or yon. I'm a Republican, and I don't get too awfully one-sided about anything anymore, because I kind of want to sit down and talk about it and approach it in a little calmer manner. And I think that's going to be what brings America through a lot of what's always brought America through its problems. And I think it's what's going to continue to bring America through its problems, is the bulk of us want to sit down and get a cup of coffee. Let's talk about it instead of banging each other on the things we disagree on. Let's find some things that we agree on and see if we can't work from there to work out the disagreement.
I love that. Find the humanity in each other. And at the end of the day, most people just want their kids to be healthy and happy and have a good cup of coffee, watch a few sports, maybe go out and take the trail hike or whatever. But it's not good theater. And I don't watch TV and the news, except for, I only watch sports, but, and it's too negative and divisive. But if I find that if I go anywhere and just talk to people and mostly listen, that I like whoever I'm talking to. It's the rare, you know, you get the sociopath wandering around every now and again.
You know, you're the, what I call the middle of the road, and that's a middle of the road. That's I always pictured that as the safest, best place to be, was right in the middle of the road. And if you just picture that, if you picture yourself that way, if you're out banging your hammer and trying to make people see it's your way and only your way, well, you know, there's a hell of a lot of us here, and it can't all share the same. You know, let's be a little more tolerant. Let's talk about it. And let's find something we enjoy together, talk about that. We get in good humor, then we'll approach the differences and maybe we can split the difference, you know?
And like your team in 72 and 73 or any company or any family, it only works if everybody's working together towards a common goal with respect, straight shooting, honesty, no name calling. And just really, I love that your highlights are all about when the team wins. And if we could feel that way about our country and ourselves and our family, I don't want to win if somebody else loses. I don't, to me, that's losing. I'd rather everybody win. And I'm happy to eat a little less or do a little less so somebody else can have a few bites too. I don't need to hog it. I want as many happy folks as possible. We're here for about 5 seconds if we're lucky. So why not just be pleasant about it? And guys like us, I feel like, be a gracious winner. That's my responsibility at this point.
Gracious winning and sympathy. You know, that's what a gracious winner is. He's sympathetic to the fact that the other guy lost, you know, or the other person lost. And that's when you get out in nature, it's a very forgiving, tolerant world and peaceful. It's got an order to it and a tranquility to it that, well, I find it very relaxing, very rewarding. So we went down this road about Alaska, and that's kind of how I feel about it. That's the reason I went. I realized when I did the TV show how many other people share that enthusiasm towards Alaska in the lower 48. And I'll tell you this, and if you're out there listening, if you're one of them, find a way to get there. It's going to be what you want it to be. If you thought Yosemite was cool, if you liked some of the national parks down here, wait till you get to Alaska. Go north, my friend.
Larry, what gives you the most joy at this stage in your life? What brings you the most joy, I should say?
Audrey Bradshaw.
Oh.
She's my wife, and she just tickles the fire out of me because she, I say her more than the grandchildren or the great-grandchildren because I'm 24/7 with her. And when I get my hands on my great grandchildren or my grandchildren, I just love it. Every minute of it. They come up a ping pong table and a foosball table set up in the basement. And some of my great grandsons are 4 and 5 and they don't really want to know about the rules, which is kind of a typical Zonka trait. They just want to take the paddle and hit the balls all over and see if you can't hit grandpa on the forehead with it, you know? So when we get together with them, I think family, to answer your question, family is what's number one. I, you know, pick out a single person. Well, certainly Audrey's with me 24/7, but I'm proud of all of them that constitute my family from the very beginning. And I look forward to seeing brothers and sisters as well as aunts and uncles. I don't have too many left, but I've got a lot of nieces and nephews, all different descriptions, all different, citizens in their own right, all colors and combinations, and I love them all. And it's fun to see them and get together with them. And listen, they're all over the country. We got them on the West Coast, up north, down in Florida, and here in North Carolina. So it's that is what I enjoy. I think the older you get, particularly when you pass 65, you start to look back at the family. And of course, the young family is so busy, it's hard. But if you get lucky enough to get the kids, and oh my gosh, are the kids busy today? My goodness, there's so much more. This the whole world has changed as far as the kids' time. When I was the age of some of my great grandsons, I spent my time out in the woods with the critters. They're so in touch with so many different people. They take my cell phone from me and correct whatever's wrong with it and hand it back to me. And they're 4.5 years old, you know. What's going on?
I'm glad we dodged the technology when we were young. I was out in the Everglades all the time being chased by all kinds of wild shit. And we were so dumb. We're lucky we're still alive. But
that's true. That's
And we were not allowed to be out there. Mom and Dad, God bless them in heaven. They're listening, going, I'm sure they knew we were out there. Right. Come back all bitten up by stuff. And we were chased by things, like, but we'd go right back out every chance we got. It was, you know, little boys, man.
That's how I grew up. Exactly. We got that in common. But I grew up in Ohio, and there wasn't that much wild stuff. That was too fearful. But the Everglades is a dangerous place, but at the same time, it was a fun place. I enjoyed it. I was, you know, 21, 22, and Fernandez and I and Stanford, a bunch of us, every time we'd get 2 days off, we were gone, Betty. We were out there fishing and enjoying being out in the Glades, in the Outback. That was a lot of fun. I enjoyed that.
What's the secret to a great marriage? We know what a good team wins. Is it similar components? Obviously tolerance and obviously Audrey's probably saint-like being, but what are some of the things that you've learned in these 70 years that make a marriage and a relationship work so well?
I think patience, tolerance, and just a willingness to see the other point of view. I can't really tell you. We have our ups and downs like anyone. It wouldn't insult your intelligence. We have good days, we have bad days. But there's an overall sympathy that we have, a shared outlook that we respect each other in the sense that we can have difference of opinions and get pretty poignant about it. But at the same time, it doesn't change the feelings we have for each other. And that's Audrey loves the outdoors just the same way I do. And when we discovered that about each other, you know, 30 years ago, it was just, let's go to Alaska and do something about it. And she was my partner. She laid out where we went and how we went and how we shot the shows, and which was great because I needed somebody like Shula to diagram the plays on the wall, you know, because I can do that. But as far as me deciding, I'd still be up there flipping a coin on which way we're going. But I think all of that blends into a relationship that, and when you find the right person, you'll know it.
In your wildest dreams growing up on a farm, did you ever think you'd have such an extraordinary life between superstardom, success, almost dying, the Northern Lights touching you, Audrey, all of it? I mean, do you ever just stop for a moment and go, wow, did I hit the lottery?
Yeah, every once in a while you look back, you take time and start to look back during the course of your career, and you're young and things are happening fast. You don't look back as much. When you get post 50 or past 50, you start to look back a little bit. When you get past 65 or 70, you start to look back a lot. And I think enjoying my relatives, enjoying my grandsons, my great-grandsons, I did with my grandsons, but I'm enjoying my great-grandsons and great-granddaughters as much or more, because I have more time to do it now and more time to concentrate on it. It's not just something that happens here and there. We plot it now. We think about it, plot how it's going to work and how it's going to happen. And I think that those are things that if you live long enough and you're lucky enough to be successful enough to be comfortable and be able to do those things, what's the definition of success? You know, I think being old enough that you don't have to worry that you're comfortable. You've got medical things provided, and you can enjoy your grandchildren, your great grandchildren's a blessing that most Americans, I think, would share with me in saying that if you live long enough, that's the supreme enjoyment, is to look back and have your great grandson take your cell phone out of your hand and update it and hand it back to you and smile, you know, and then hit you between the eyes with a ping pong ball.
I got to let you go in a minute. Any fear of whatever's beyond this plane, of dying? I mean, or did the Northern Lights and being on that boat kind of take some of that away?
Paul, at 76, is around the corner. A lot of other fellas go, and it's just the natural course of events. When you're 22, you have a real fear of dying. When you're 72, it's much less, because it's a natural thing and you've lived most of your life. I think the fear at 22 is not getting a chance to live your life before it's ended. And that's more fearful than anything, because enjoying your life and being at ease with yourself and feeling secure and being an American and being amongst us in the greatest place on the face of the world to be, we're in it. And we have an opportunity to enjoy it. And cut that short, that would be my fear. I'd be afraid of dying because I want to live a life here. And we're in the right place to do it.
You've been listening to the What Matters Most podcast, a 100% listener-supported program. If you feel inspired, please go to our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/whatmattersmost and join our family. So until the next time, stay inspired and in the light.